I ran the New York Marathon and I want to do it again. And you have to understand that, like, you are running a marathon if you want to, like, accomplish great things.
Welcome to Shopify Masters, your companion for starting and building a business. I'm your host, Serena Smith. Breaking into the footwear industry is no small feat, but one brand is making major strides. Since launching in 2020 with just $4,000 and a Shopify site, La Rudet has scaled into a do-it-all fashion powerhouse with 550 employees and full control over its production. It's also been crowned one of the most innovative companies by Fast Company and Brand of the Year at the Footwear News Achievement Awards. Here to walk us through the journey are the visionaries behind the brand, co-founders Marina and Ricardo La Rudet. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having us.
Hi, Serena. Thank you so much for having us.
You launched in 2020, which is like in the depths of the pandemic, as we all recall. Was that by design or did you launch out of necessity?
Oh, completely out of necessity. It was, you know, month one of the pandemic. Both Ricardo was furloughed. I was like full on fired. You know, we were home and we're like, what are we going to do now, right? What can we do to make a better future for like ourselves? So then, you know, I had a vision of what I thought that the white space was in the market, right? As a woman, as a client, as, you know, experienced through my Barney's years and seeing clients there. And then Ricardo did a deep, deep dive into the footwear industry. And we came into a realization that the white space was real, right? That there was this super high-end brands and then the lower-end brands, but nothing in between that was talking to the clients that we're talking today. And so we started, you know, out of our living room, the two of us working nonstop. And we had so many incredible stories to share.
And you were fully bootstrapped in the beginning?
Oh, until today, we are bootstrapped.
Wow.
Well, we never got big funding in the beginning. It was really, I think we took an approach that we started doing things gradually. So we built the website. We got some samples done. Some retailers started picking us up. We didn't do any digital marketing in the beginning. We did some very good PR. And I think because we're at the depths of the crisis of the pandemic, also that benefited. Because no one was out there. We felt like crazy folks. It was very, you know, we were launching in December. Everyone was looking forward to get it over with the pandemic, you know, looking for spring, looking for flowers. And so we were a great story. And I do think that whenever everyone is like very afraid of doing new things, that's usually the best time to doing things.
And I think Ricardo and I, you know, we lived through the 2008 crisis, right? We were already working in New York and we saw what that effect had. And then we also saw that 2010 was one of the best years in retail. So once we were putting the brand together, there was nothing else to lose. It was, everything was a plus. If we sell one shoe, it was great, right? In our second month of La Rudet, we sold $5,000 and we were celebrating. And now we do that in a matter of like minutes, right? And we are still celebrating. So like, since we're starting from zero, everything is a celebration. And that's the beauty about like a startup, right? And how you were able to do new things. And every day it's a new achievement, right? Thank God we are in a skyrocket like problem that is just like growing and not like in a submarine that you were like a sinking ship. But it's still like there's a lot of growth because we did that out of our dining room with two people. And then now Ricardo, it's, you know, in the facility out in Brazil where we have 550 people. And that we bootstrap and we are very scrappy and we... It was a lot of work and still is, you know, to make that possible.
That's a dizzying amount of growth in less than 5 years. I mean, it really is a remarkable story, right?
It is.
It's not normal. It's not supposed to be this way. There's a lot of work and a lot of luck too. That is for sure. That's an argument Marina and I have all the time. I think that there's more luck involved in things. She thinks it's pure hard work and talent.
I strongly believe that just trust the luck and see where that's going to lead you. Do you understand? That's the joke. For like someone like me that wake up at 5 a.m., it's answering emails. It's like working 14 hours a day. It's every day. There's no Saturday. There's no Sunday. And then you tell me, oh, it's luck. I'm like...
No, but that's the minimum. That's what I say. The hard work is the minimum. I mean, we're both Brazilian and American. You know, tapping into the American market is obviously an amazing, you know, market to grow into. Having an industry that was dormant for so long, that's luck. I didn't do anything for that to happen. You know, that's just an opportunity that presented itself. Being both Brazilian, like I can come here, I speak Portuguese to everyone. I understand how things work. Having the experience of 20 years of Marina combining with 20 years of operating and finance with me, we didn't have to work hard for any of these things that we said. Now, I think that as an advice to like entrepreneurs, there's just some things that have been handed to you. Some things you got to work very hard to build. But some things you just happen to be in the right place at the right time. Look for those. That's something that I think it's good advice for entrepreneurs. That obviously, you got to do things, but maybe look at things that you have a unique point right now, because that tends to be a good thing, because you're going to be unbeatable in that thing.
And what were those things that you were able to identify as either giving you guys a unique leg up in the industry, or things that just felt like they might be coalescing into something that was kind of lucky for you and La Rude?
Like, obviously the name, I didn't have to work hard for this name. It is a name that sounds good. Like, people get curious about it. They don't know if it's French. They don't know if it's Spanish. They don't know if it's...
It does sound good.
That's one for sure. And I think value comes from being able to cross borders and find things that could do well in one place and sell well in the other thing, or vice versa. And we happen to be dual citizens of both countries. So Marina's experience of working 20 years in fashion, she had been to, I think she did the math once, it was like 3,000, 4,000 fashion shows. She has met maybe all the big designers. She has a sense and a feeling for how the industry works. And she's also a very nice person. She built an amazing goodwill across the industry. And now we get to collaborate with a lot of these folks.
Right. And I would imagine that there's this feeling, given your background in the industry, Marina, with Barney's and Teen Vogue and Style.com. I mean, you've got your bona fides for sure, that there's also this sense of like cachet with like bringing in all the people. And so I would imagine it's like a bit of a mindset shift to then say, actually, we actually don't need any of that. We can do this on our own.
And listen, I do have, you know, my creative person has worked with me for 10 years. And then we were like, okay, what can we do here to make it happen? So we use all the training that I had at these amazing places. And then we made it work within our universe, right? And this is what I tell the team. I'm like, we're still going to do the best that we can, but we do not have Barney's budget. Like, you know, and it's funny because we won Brand of the Year last year with On Running. And we did one campaign that it's like a Muppet saying La Rude. And then later on, I think 3 months later, On Running did a similar campaign, but it's Roger Federer.
I think it was with Elmo, and Elmo, it was like, it's the same vibe.
But then ours is a newcomer model with a Muppet that we bought on Amazon, right? And it's the model in her, like, La Rude. And then 3 months later, it's Roger Federer and Elmo having a conversation on how to say On Running. And I was like, listen, the concept, it's identical, but I do not have Roger or Elmo. And this, I say it for the entrepreneurs out there. And even if you see like Alex Cooper, right? She didn't start being Alex Cooper. She started doing podcasts from her house, you know? So it's so possible.
You know, I'm sure you guys are aware of the concept of lifestyle creep, right? Like, you know, you're in a certain bracket and you're scrappy and whatever, and then you start to make more money and you're like, okay, well, I'm going to go to the fancier gym and I'm going to get the nicer car and maybe we'll upgrade the house, right? But it sounds as though you've managed to maintain this really scrappy mentality despite this pretty meteoric growth. Does that feel right?
Serena, we chose wisely, right? Because we didn't have, let's say, investors' money. And when I say that, not disrespectfully, because I think we would spend everyone's money as wisely as we have spent ours. But for 2 years, we didn't have an office in New York. It was out of my living room. And believe me, I want everyone in the office. So people would come to my house and we would have like this office that was there, right? So it wasn't like, oh, a work from home situation type of thing. I had like 3 people coming in at the time. But we invest in our first factory in Brazil and we had 70 people working there. So we were very diligent with the money on where we would allocate better, right? So we have always been very wise in those decisions. They were like, okay, it does make sense right now to invest in a factory and not in a showroom in New York.
I want to dig into this a little bit more because when you initially launched, you were not entirely vertically integrated, but you made that decision to make that shift at a certain point. So what was the thought process around that? And why did you start to make that transition when you did?
Beginning of last year was when I was like, yeah, this needs to happen. But when we first started the business, we're like, okay, let's see if there's a product market fit and we would, you know, make the shoes with factories. The moment that we would sell out of things that we needed to replace, and I would call the factory and say, hey, you remember the ones that you did 200 of? I need now 600. They would say, hey, it's okay. I'll give it to you in 120 days or 90 days. I said, by that time, the summer's over. It's not quick enough. And they said, well, but I got to order the leather and then I order the thing. I said, why don't you have black leather in your things? Well, because I order for a bunch of people. I said, well, how do I get this guy to align with me? And I tried with the factories to say, let's do a model that I open up my finances and you open yours so we can be aligned. But you ultimately, when you transfer risk from one party to the next one, you kind of break the business down. So I said, I need to learn how to make these things. And I would come down here, and it was one of my employees at the time. I would go into a factory and say, but how much did these cost? And it was just a bunch of white machines around. And it took me a few months, and eventually people gave it to me. And I said, but how much do these people make? And when I put the math together, and I was like, so if I built one of these, I literally, in one order, I pay for all of this? Like one order. I was like, do it now. And I called the guy with the used machines and I said, I would like to buy all these machines. The guy put a list of like all everything that was needed. It was like $200,000 to do it then. But that's what I would pay one factory for one small order to do shoes.
That was like the first one. And then he came home. He was like, we're doing this. And I was like, excuse me, what? I'm like, I was just like so nervous.
Because we grew to the point that I had 4 factories. So all the developments, I would go to all these different ones. And whatever I developed in one, I couldn't get it to produce the other one. I was like, man, this is not working. So I got to get it all together. So then I was like, I need a new office anyways, because we were 6 people at the time when I first started in Brazil. And then we were already going to like 12 people and I couldn't fit them all in the same room again. So I started looking for a bigger office and I was like, well, maybe I can find an office that has a place that I can put these machines in and I could do some samples, maybe 50 pairs a day or 20 pairs a day or something. And then I got like a place that I could do. And then we started with, you know, 16 people we hired. And then we started producing and then I was like, okay, we got to reorder. And then I went to the factory like, yeah, it's going to be 120 days. And I called my guys and I said, how long would it take if you guys use it? Ah, we can do it in 3 weeks. I was like, deal. So I started to make more things inside the factory. And then we got to like do 300 pairs inside the smaller factory. And then I still had my factory could do maybe 20%, 30% of everything that I needed, all the samples and everything that I reordered. I was like, okay, let's go all in. This building, which is 100,000 square feet, became available. I came in, I leased it. I moved that other place here and I tripled the number of machines. And that's when we hired all these people. So I just buy a bunch of leather and I sell shoes. That's what basically what we do.
So that's where, Serena, the luck really plays. We spent 20 years as an immigrant here, really working very hard in America and understanding what it is to work, you know, in America. But then when we had to outsource shoes, Brazil, it was where we grew up.
It's the largest producer in the Western Hemisphere, yeah.
Yes. And then like this region alone produced 3 times more than Italy, right? So we know how to navigate the culture there. So it was easier than if you had to build it from scratch in a place that you don't know anything. And we still had to build it from scratch with people that we don't know, but at least we understood the language and could open a bank account in Brazil. Let's put it this way.
You guys are fully vertically integrated, which just means you're doing everything in-house, as you said, Ricardo, like I buy the leather and I make the shoes. Is there also a case to be made for other entrepreneurs out there who are in like the fashion space for not doing it via that approach and keeping things to some degree outsourced?
Some things you should have outsourced for sure. But I highly believe that if you want to be in the digital space and you're in fashion, which has a lot of variability, and by nature, it's going to have things that change, you got to be vertically integrated in some degree, or you got to have a supply chain that's super tight. So I think vertical integration allows you to have a very differentiated product, and that's key. So if you just do like a MBA brand that someone has a palette color, you know, that pastels and does a bag or something, if you're good, 10 people are going to pop up and they're going to call the same factory that you're doing. And it's going to be very hard to compete when you're doing that. If you're going to be a product first company, which is most good companies do, you got to come up with something that you're the only one that gets to do that. So shoes are pretty hard to make. So whatever I'm learning on how to do, whatever I'm learning how to bend leather a certain way, whatever I'm learning how to, you know, make a specific roll of a shoe, I should try to keep it in place. The second thing that's worth to do vertical integration is that the explosion of the platforms that you can do through TikTok or for Instagram or for any access in people, you don't know like if eventually your thing goes viral. And if that does happen, if you are able to ramp up production at that velocity, you're going to be able to capture. If you can't, someone else is going to do it and you're not going to have a competitive advantage. I did not know how complicated it was to do it. Thank God, because ignorance is a blessing sometimes. If you're willing to put the work in, you can do great things.
For us, it was baby steps, right? It's not that we built a company with 550 people, then we went to market. We tested out the market and we tested out product. And so it's possible. That's all what I'm saying. It's like, as long as you have a vision and the execution later on.
Can you explain Larue's direct-to-demand model and what that allows for both internally as a company and on the consumer end?
The direct-to-demand is really making my whole factory setup of the leather, the soles, the uppers, and standardize like this shoe here. I can cover it with denim. I can cover it with raffia. I can cover it with whatever. I can change this upper to be a boot. I can change this, you know. So for me to stock this piece inside and these soles, that's nothing for me. And then just like when you walk into a McDonald's, you can order a Big Mac. And if the Big Mac is not done, they'll have the upper bun, the patties, everything. And it's the same patty that goes in the cheeseburger. So there's pieces in common, you know, buttons and hardware and stuff. You just plan it that way.
You know, it is a more sustainable business model because we're not producing excess inventory, right? But it is in a way that we present to clients, you know, the up-and-coming collection or the up-and-coming drop. People start ordering, you know, within that, you know, 6 weeks time frame. And then we ship it to them. As soon as we start getting the orders, then we start like producing it. But then it also give us, you know, if a client really like a certain type of shoe, we go and we design more shoes that are similar to that. And we're able to launch those new shoes like in a week from that day, right? So we launch new things on a weekly basis based on the data of what the customers are responding immediately. So our turnaround to launch new things internally is around like a week to 2 weeks, depending on what we are working on. I don't want to use the word fast fashion in that sense, because what we're doing is, let's say that the customer was really responding to the raffia with black piping way above any other ones. So we're like, oh my God, the clients really want this material. Let's take this material in our best-selling styles and recolor them right now. And then we do a drop just for that, right? So then we chase the demand to what the customers are responding to. If you were comparison, let's say like everyone last year, there was about like the jelly sandal, right? Or the jelly ballerina. And if you can chase reorders and do the demand, you can do that in that month or that summer. What happens is for all the big houses, they are placing their orders in China or Italy, and they can only chase that demand for the next year. So a year from this summer, you're still going to see that because everyone is placing their orders at the factory based on last summer's. And we do that based on the last 5 days.
Mm. Yeah, it's like it actually allows you to operate in a much faster and more nimble fashion from an iteration process and being able to produce new items based on the direct feedback that you're getting from your customers. But it, to me, also feels like almost the antithesis of fast fashion, because you're also asking your customers to invest in something and buy into something and then wait a little bit. And in a universe where it feels like our entire world has sort of been bred on instant gratification, it kind of requires a shift in psychology for the customer to say, this is worth it, and I'm going to wait for it a little while before I get this thing.
And for the client, right, we also offer them, let's say we launch fall, all the boots at 30% discount. So it's like, you know what? Instead of you waiting for Black Friday to then buy your boots, why don't you buy in July or August at that premium price. And we're going to make that for you, right? So you can buy your shoe at the price that you would buy, let's say, at a Black Friday ahead of it. If Prada did that, I was like, you know, Miu Miu or all the other brands, don't you want to buy from them? Talk about privilege and luck, right? I was able to buy from my designer friends at wholesale price throughout my entire career. And then so my friends would be like, oh, yes, you only got this because you had that wholesale price. And I was like, sure, yeah, that's true. And Ricardo was saying the same thing. I could get home because he knew that I was buying at a discount. And it was like, let's offer that to the client.
How thrilling to be offered that discount.
Yes, exactly. It's phenomenal, you know? And then we were like, okay, so maybe we can have more women being able to buy our shoes.
Just like airlines, or you can't just make more flights. So the supply is limited. Quality shoes and quality products have a limited supply. So what do you do if you, a lot of the buying you're doing is for an occasion that you actually can plan ahead, or something that you should be planning ahead because you're dealing with very expensive materials. So when you're buying a ticket and you need to go to Miami or you need to go to the beach, you're buying 3 months in advance because you want to get a cheaper price. Right? If you're buying last minute, you should be buying a much higher price. Now, I know we always mess up. But the truth is, when you have a limited supply, you should incentivize people to buy early. And it's actually more profitable to do it that way. And I think it's a lot more environmental. It's just more ethical to do it that way.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I'm picking up on here. Like, there's obviously a very clear business case for this, but there is also, there's a philosophical component to this as well, which is like, be mindful of where you're spending your dollars, invest in the things that really matter, have a sense of excitement around it. When it comes, then it's a thing that you actually want to hang on to. It changes your whole relationship with the way that we engage with stuff, you know?
Yes, 100%. And we don't do everything pre-order. Like, there's some things that we know it's always coming, so we can keep some minimal level of inventory, but we're not taking massive risks ahead of a season. So that's how we do it.
Okay, I want to ask you guys, because you went from the two of you, husband and wife with kids, to now 550 employees, it's like almost hard to even wrap your head around how massive that kind of shift is from a team perspective. And your operations are partly out of New York and partly out of Brazil. So what's your approach to hiring and retaining talent? And what is the culture of La Rude?
We have learned a lot of things along the way. But as founders, we are very hands-on and we build the company, right? From ground up, literally like designing the website ourselves. And we pass through every era of the company, right? So culturally, to work with us, the executive knows how to get done themselves. It's not a company that you can just like delegate and do the PowerPoint. It's a good fit with us if that leader can lead and execute at the same time.
I think that the people that did better and became leaders at La Rude are the people that also can recruit. I'd sit down and say, listen, I love you. You're great. But if you're only yourself, you're useless to me. You got to find five people like you. And then some of these people actually get to cross-pollinate. So that's the thing that we do to grow. I do a lot of recruiting myself. Marina does a lot of recruiting. I think founders are responsible for gathering capital for the business, but it's gathering human capital. That's super important. I'm always scouting people from the region here, people in New York. I actually became better at identifying talent and people that can work with us very well.
Can you identify a few of those traits or a sense of aptitude that you can now recognize in somebody that makes you realize that they're going to be successful?
People that are not embarrassed not to know things are definitely a thing for us. Like people, and you ask them, saying they come up with answers and stuff, that's usually not a good trait for me. So for someone that says, you know what, I ask something, I have no clue. That's a good person usually. I say that's also the person that gets thrown off a boat. You know, there's a bunch of sharks. There's some people just scream. And some people just put their hand down in the water to look for sharks to punch them in the nose. People that can deal in crisis well, that they kind of go into their zone, those are good people too. I think that ethics is a very important thing for us. If I start to see that they have bendable about what's right and what's wrong, that usually doesn't work with us either. I say that's usually people with good energy, very smart, and very ethical. If you have those three, that's perfect. If you have one of the three missing, usually it's a bad thing. But for sure, the one that you shouldn't miss is the ethical one, because you're going to get robbed if that happens.
Totally. How on earth did the two of you navigate being married and also working together? And also this thing that you're working at together is your business.
We have all the very hard conversations, right? So we have been married for 22 years. So there's nothing that is left unsaid. It doesn't matter if it hurts the feelings of both of us. So having honest conversation really helps. We are co-founders, right? And we want the same goal for the company, no matter what. And we want to get there, no matter what. But he is the CEO, and I am the creative director, still a co-founder. So I know my space within the company. But then, of course, if something in any area, right, it's not working, he's like, Marina, you're a co-founder. Go there, like, you know. Help me out here. So I use that co-founder energy to go to every department that it's needed, right? But I know my area. And then when you are growing to such a tremendous amount of growth that we are having, right? That it's this hyper growth. I'm not going to lie. It's difficult. It's very challenging. It's challenging on the body. We were in LA, then he went to Brazil, then I'm going to Brazil again. Then it's like, it's a lot. So like, that's what it takes, right? It's like running a marathon, you know, and I ran the New York Marathon and I want to do it again. And you have to understand that like you're running a marathon if you want to like accomplish great things.
Between the two of us, we've always been very connected since the day we met. We talk a lot. I think we're best friends also. We trust each other a lot. And we have honest conversations. So not having taboos or stuff that you don't talk about is a good thing. And then as you described, having clear roles, not only to the two of us, but for the rest of the company to understand is very important.
That mutual trust is so incredibly key in any co-founder relationship and also in any marriage. And also, Marina, 5 years is like a really long marathon.
And like, I'm not seeing the end of the tunnel. I'm like, okay, like, let's keep on doing it. It's just like beyond the triathlon right now.
I tell her the last 12 months have been really transformational.
And listen, one of my favorite books that I ever read, it is Shoe Dog from the founder of Nike. And one line stuck to me that it's him at the end of the book when he did the IPO for Nike and he was already like older, whatever. When he saw that everything was perfect, right? And they asked him, do you have one regret? And he says that I cannot do it all over again. So, and this brings tears to my eyes. And I say it because although it's challenging, right? And I want to say all the founders out there, it is challenging. It's like Ricardo and I, we trust each other and we can conquer all the work because it's two of us, right? And we try to conquer as much as possible and we want to duplicate and multiply ourselves. So, but I also try to see it and be like, you know what? It's a great experience that we're having, right? To be able to offer 550 jobs, you know, coming from unemployment to all these families and be able to offer them like healthcare. It is a privilege, right? And we are in it. But I want to tell all the other founders out there, don't read the success stories and be like, oh, yes. And then like everything's fine. Keep pedaling. You have to keep doing the work,
There's another founder who's a friend of mine, Ellen Bennett of Headley and Bennett. And she has this great reframe, like when you're in a moment of deep stress and you're just like, oh God, what is happening? And when am I ever going to sleep again? And why is this so hard? She then says to herself, how lucky am I that I get to do this? You know, and bringing yourself back into that sense of privilege.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. We're going to wrap up very shortly because you guys have been so generous.
No, I can talk forever.
We can talk forever, clearly. But you keep teasing us with these like mentions of like hyper growth. Can you like give us like some juicy numbers? Like how quickly are you growing?
I think that the first half of the year has been 300% since the first half of the last year. We're really growing that fast. But the thing is the model that has the pre-order allows us to grow with very little working capital. June alone was like 400%, you know, of what it was June of the previous year. It's been that fast. It's but the financing thing is that the business, almost like Shein, had that incredible growth because they were able to grow and only do the things that really the clients want. It really has gone vertical. That it really is hyper growth mode.
By so many metrics, you could say, okay, we've done it, we've arrived, we've blown past all of the goals. And yet I have the sense that there's more for you coming down the pike.
Oh no, the business is still like, it's still massive. We're crossing 9 digits, you know, annual revenue, but the market is much bigger. The market is much bigger. When you see brands like Tory Burch or Stuart Weitzman, Kate Spade, when you add them together, those alone add to 3 billion. You know, it's still a massive business. It's still, the market is really big. Every once in a while, there's a disruptor in the footwear business because it's so hard to come in. On Running is a billion that's doing 2 billion in sales. It was founded 11 years ago. 2 billion in sales. It was founded 11 years ago. So we are crossing, you know, 9 digits. We have a lot of way to go. So that's the thing.
Yeah, we're still very small. You know, yeah. We're still, I don't want to say a mom and pop, but we're still very small.
It's a mom and pop.
It's a mom and pop with 550 employees.
It is. But it is. It really is that way.
Yeah, that's how it feels like.
So speak it into existence. Where is La Rude in 5 years?
I think we're going to be 9 years, a household name. We're a leader in footwear. There's a lot of other brands that exist through La Rude because we do these collaborations. And well, I think that there's a way to do footwear that we can actually enable a lot of designers and other brands to do footwear in a much more efficient way. And I think that there will be probably in the next 1 year or two, there'll be other verticals that we're going to explore. I think handbags is definitely going to happen. We're going to get into men's footwear as well. So I think we'll be a multiple of times where we are today. Hopefully it'll be about 10 times, I hope. But let's see.
I believe it. This has been such an absolutely delightful conversation. I so appreciate your candor and the Brazilian spirit that you're bringing to all of this. Thank you, Ricardo, Marina.
Thank you, Serena.
Thank you so much. Thank you. It's been a pleasure, you know.
That's Marina and Ricardo La Rude, founders of La Rude. Shopify Masters is produced by Alicia Clark and Gogo Zoger. Our engineers are Matt Schwartz and Miku Betlam, and I'm your host, Serena Smith. Come back every Tuesday and Thursday to catch a brand new episode of Shopify Masters, and be sure to watch our video interviews on the Shopify Masters YouTube channel. Until next time, thanks for listening. Go buy some shoes.